I came to Sioux Falls back in 22. I came down from North Dakota. I was born in Tinvik, North Dakota. I had two sisters, one older sister, Hilda, 2 years older, and one younger sister, Esther, 2 years younger. And anyway, I was a photographer at Minneapolis, Kiel Studio in Minneapolis. And I got a draft notice and a letter in the mail, and it said, a letter from the FBI, and said if I didn't report to a certain doctor in a certain town, I don't remember which town it was, in a certain time and day, and that they would come and get me, and I'd end up in Leavenworth Prison down there. But just the word prison scares you to death, practically.
And sure. And what year was this that you received that letter?
In 41. It must have been in November of 41. And so I quit my job, and I came home to Sioux Falls because I didn't want to get drafted in that area. So I came home to Sioux Falls and went down to the draft board and seen the draft board. And I was the only son, and my mother was not a widow, but my parents divorced when I was 12 years old. And so I went to the draft board and tried to reason with them because there was no war and anything. And I wasn't a bum or anything. So went to the draft board, and I remember this one farmer was sitting on a draft board, and I remember him especially, and he sitting there, and he had his thumbs in his overalls straps, and he had a large stomach, and he was sitting there, and he said, "It's riffraff like you that we're going to get off the street, and you're in the Army." So it made me feel real good, and I was riffraff. And so the 2nd of December, I was at the bus depot in Sioux Falls, and there was about 30 of us on the bus there. And on the way down, most of the fellas on the bus were celebrating and drinking the time they was drinking, you know, drunk. And the time we got to Fort Brooke, that camp, and it was night, and we were bivouacked or quartered there. And the next day we had our physical, and then we had to stay overnight there again, and they checked us again. And the next day, there were just about three or four of us that passed the physical, because the rest of them had too high a blood pressure, and
probably from drinking.
And yes, no drinking. They kept them a couple more days, and they got. Anyway, we're standing there, and they wanted to know if we was going to pledge allegiance to the United States and join the United States Army, and you hold up your hands, and if you didn't, why, you'd end up in a prison in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And wowie, I mean to say, that prison was, I was down to Fort Leavenworth, and that's huge, and a prison, and that didn't appeal to me at all. And I raised my hand up, and I joined the Army.
And how old were you?
I was 21, and so I ended up in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and was in a barracks there, and it was on a Sunday, December the 7th, and I was laying there in my bunk, and I remember we was in the upstairs room, and I was in the center aisle, and over the radio guy had a radio playing, and it says, "The Japs bombed Pearl Harbor," and says that we're going to have a war with Japan. Wowie, that. I know it sunk, because they had a stipulation that when I got drafted in the Army, that you had to serve a year and a day. And that year and a day lasted 4 years and 2 days. And so the next day, it was Monday, a fella came to me, a sergeant came to me, and he said, "Your name Barrett?" I said, "Yes." He says, "You take... go down to building so-and-so and see Major." So, I don't remember what the Major's was, but he's a little scrawny doctor. I remember him just as plain as can be. And so I went in and I saluted Barrett and said, "Do you know how to develop X-ray film?" He said, "Or film?" And I says, "Is it any different than other film?" He says, "No." Well, he said, "Go back there and see Sergeant Bruin in the X-ray department. So I went back there, and here's Sergeant Bruin. He is about my size. He is pretty bald-headed, and he is smoking a cigar. And he is a sergeant, a buck sergeant. And he said, you know how to develop film? And I says, is it any different than other film? He says, no. He says, come in here. And the dark room went in, and he said, this is a setup. He says, here's the fix, and here's the wash. And he said, yeah, you fix them for a while, take the out of the frame and put them in the wash, hook them up in front of the wash, hang them here. And then he said, take them out of here in a certain time. It was dark, a little light in there. He said, put them over here in the wash. And he says, after they're in there so long, he said, you take them out and hang them up so they dry. And he says, then you take them out of there, and you take them to Captain so-and-so. I don't remember his name. And so I took him into the captain, and he would read them, x-rays, chest x-rays, and other x-rays.
So this is how a photographer became a medic in World War II.
Well, he's the medical department. He was in the medics. Once you get in the medics, you never get out. And so I wanted to end up in the Air Corps, be an aerial photographer. But that was out of the picture. But anyway, I was working for Sergeant Bruin for a while, and the fellow that did the chest wreck series up, something happened to him, and he was gone, so I lost that job, and I was out there in the x-ray department setting up the chest x-rays. And we had 800 fellas coming in every day, and they'd walk in here, and they were nude, and they're walking in there lined up, and here's the x-ray, chest x-ray thing, and it would be up and down, you know, and they'd come there, and they'd put their chin up on the top of the x-ray thing, and I'd have them fold their hands and back and put their shoulders ahead, and then I'd stab up in back of this here shield, was supposed to lead, and then the fella would have snapped the x-ray. And I did that for a year and a half, and it was pretty monotonous, and I was on guard duty at night sometimes, and then you had to scrub the floors, especially on Saturday, and you're just a corporal, and you got just about $5 a month. But you see, you had cigarettes, and you had all your food, and theaters was only a nickel, and you did what you had to do, and the food was good, and so I got pretty monotonous of that. I mean, and a fellow by the name of Harvey, let's see, what was his name, Harvey, anyway, he was from Gas City, Kansas, I remember, Lyle G. Harvey, that's what his name was, and he said, Ed, I'm putting a transfer in, he says, to OCS, Officers Candidate School. He said, you get out of there, and he said, we could go into that, and he says, we could become warrant officers, he says, or end up in the medical supply. And he said, we'd get a lot more pay, and he said, we'd get out of here. And he said, how about going with me and signing up for that? And I says, what do you have to do? And so we ended up in that. We ended up in OCS and ended up in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, in the Signal Corps. Well, I didn't pass. I ended up, so they gave me a chance to, had a choice, either end to stay in the Signal Corps, and man, they lived in tents, and pretty rough.
In New Jersey, they lived in tents?
Oh,
is that
yeah,
where you are?
In the Signal Corps. If I was going to be in the Signal Corps, I'd end up in that. So they said, you can either go back to your old outfit or stay in the Signal Corps. Well, man, I said, I'll go back to my old outfit. So I ended up back in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, reported to the major, I forget his name. I reported to the major, and he says, fine. He said, good to see you back. He said, we can't use you. He said, you go up to building so-and-so and report to Captain so-and-so. So I went up there and reported to that captain. And he said, you go over to building so-and-so, and he said, bunk there, and he said, till we ship you out. So I stayed there until they shipped me out, ended up in the infantry in Fort in Camp Butner, North Carolina. And I was in Camp Butner, North Carolina in the infantry, and a sergeant came to me and he said, I was a corporal then. He said, you teach these men medical procedure, he said, first aid. So I was teaching first aid for about 2 weeks, and then we went on daily marching and hikes, 25-mile hikes and stuff like that. And I didn't know a whole lot about first aid, but I read the book and stuff like that. And so pretty soon after I was at, I think I was in that outfit about 2 or 3 weeks. So sergeant came to me and he said, Barrett, he said, get your stuff. And he says, go down this road, he said, to building so-and-so in the artillery. And so I went down there, and I reported to a captain down there, and I remember him. He wore a mustache, but I forget his name. And he was, well, he was a captain. Then he had me report to this sergeant there, and the sergeant, and I reported to him, and I was next to him. And so he said, you know anything about doing needlework? He says, giving needles and stuff like that. And I says, no, never done anything like that. I told him I was an X-ray. Well, he said, come here. So he said, go to the kitchen and get some oranges. And he had several of us there. And he said, get some oranges. And so I came back with some oranges. And he gave me an orange, and he gave me a needle syringe, and he filled it full of water. And he says, you stick that needle in that orange, and he says, draw back and see if you can get any blood or anything or any juice out of there. And you couldn't. And says, and then he says, go ahead and stick that, push that juice into that orange. And so that was a practice, given a washerman and stuff like, you know, taking blood. And so they would bring in, we'd give physicals, and they had all the fellas, or quite a few of the fellas, the soldiers that were in the invasion of Africa. An invasion of Africa came through there, and we processed thousands and thousands of it. We did that from 7 o'clock in the morning until 6 at night, and to soldiers. Plus, in the daytime we wasn't doing that, they would bring in a soldier that was in AWOL soldier, or he got in the army prison for something he did. And this soldier came in and he had contacted gonorrhea and syphilis. He had gonorrhea and syphilis. And so I forget what that sergeant's name, he came to me and he said, Barrett, go in there and give that man his shot. And it was a shirt, first shot I had to give him in his arm was McPherson. It was 10 cc's. And it was the first time I'd ever done it. And I was scared to death. And I don't know if that man, that poor man, could see I was scared. And I put the rubber around his arm so his blood vessel came up there. And I went down there and I put that needle in his blood vessel. And I says, can you taste it? And he says, yes. And so then I gave him that 10 cc of McPherson. Now, if I would have went outside of the blood vessel and gave him that stuff, his whole arm would have swelled way up. And so I got that done. And other soldiers came in.
And his arm was okay. It didn't swell up.
And it didn't swell up. And I got good at that. I got good at that as a needle expert. And then that same soldier would come in 2 weeks later, and he'd bare his butt and his buttocks. And then I'd give him 5 cc's of bismuth. It's bismuth. It's an oily solution in his rump. And I'd do that. And I did that, plus the physicals. And we'd give shots to the soldiers as they come through. We had give about 7 shots to each guy. Had to see that they had their glasses. Had to see that they had their dental work. had to see that everything was perfect. And then the sergeant above us, you know, he was responsible for that if we made any mistakes. And I remember one of the sergeants in the other division, they got a soldier all the way to California that was going to Japan, or the South Seas, you know. And he got to California and he didn't have his false teeth. He didn't have his dental work. And that sergeant lost his rating because he was supposed to check everything, you know. And so is in that outfit. So after supper, 6 o'clock supper, I was appointed to go on a cadre for another division, airborne division. And I didn't know where it was or where I was going or anything. They just told you what to do. And so after supper, you're supposed to report to a certain position there. And they had a small, not a Jeep, but it was a small pickup with a box in a canvas on top of it. And there'd be about 30 of us in the artillery there that were slated to go cadre. And we ended up in Raleigh, North Carolina at the hospital there. And the nurses taught us how to deliver a baby. We'd be in France, that maybe we'd have a chance to help out delivering of a baby. And we had to do that. We did that for 2 weeks. But about over a week or 10 days, why, they never took roll call at all. So as we were coming in, they would stop for a stop sign, and here was a beer joint. And there was a guy said, they don't take roll call anyway. And he says, I'm getting off here, and I'm going to get a beer. And I liked beer. I did a lot of beer and smoking. And several got off. There's about 9 of us got off, and I got off too because I thought I had enough education. And I got beer, and then when the pickup came back, we got back in and went back to camp. So the next morning, I was there trying to do work in the dispensary, and the sergeant came over, and he's Barrett. He said, go in and see Major so-and-so. And I went in, Major, and I remember him, and he had a little trim mustache. He said, Barrett, where were you last night when you're supposed to be in class? He says, where were you? Wowie, there I was, sunk. Well, he said, you're a private now. He said, go back to your sergeant. And he said, do your work. But he said, you lost your rating. And so I went back to the sergeant, and he said, well, Barrett, he said, take off your corporal stripes. I had buck corporal stripes. And so I ended up on KP plus working at the dispensary and guard duty and had all those extra details. And so one day the sergeant came to me, and Barrett, he said, sew your stripes back on. He said, you're going out in the cadre regardless. And so I sewed my stripes back on, and it was about a week later, why, we loaded this all up, and we went. We ended up at a camp down at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. We ended up down there, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and in the airborne artillery.
And what year was this?
This was in 43.
About 3 years now that you've been doing this.
Yeah. And the 101st Airborne Division was there, and we were right next to where they were at, and they were just about done training, and they were there about 3 months, at least 3 months. And they were training, and we were training. And we used the same dispensary that they used. And I remember their sergeant, he was a staff sergeant. He came up to me and he says, Barrett, he says, I like the way you work. He says, you get things done. And we had six medics besides me. I was a corporal, I was the head of the dispensary. And we had a captain that told us what to do and how to mix medicine and this and that. And we'd do that. And he said, Barrett, out of the way that you do things. And he says, how about coming along with us? He said, we're short. a man, and he says, we could sure use you. And I didn't have no say-so at all. And so in the meantime, I had a furlough, and I was home and seen Lillian. And so Lillian got pregnant. And so I went back to camp, and Lillian was writing letters back and forth, and I asked her how things going, and she didn't say nothing. So I got on the phone and talked to her, and I said, is anything wrong? And she said she was pregnant.
Lillian's your wife.
Yeah. And, well, she wasn't my wife yet.
Okay.
And so I went and seen my captain, and I explained to him what was going on. And he says, well, he said, Ed, is it yours? And I says, I know it's mine. I says, I've been going with that girl for almost 4 years. Got acquainted with her when she was 14. And I was older than she was. And I was a gentleman all the time. But finally, I lost my senses. And anyway, the captain says, all right, I'll give you a 10-day furlough. And he says, you got any money? I said, I haven't got any money. Well, he said, go down the Red Cross. I went down the Red Cross, seen the Red Cross, and she says, it can't be yours. He said, you sure it's yours? I said, I know the girl. I said, well, she says, are you sure? I says, I know. I said, she isn't that type of girl. And, you know, and Sioux Falls had the air base here. And so I got $200, and I came home on the train, and I met one of the neighbor boys, and he was in Nick Vigna. And he works over the VA over here. He's a volunteer. And I asked him, I was going home to get married to Lil. And he said, I said, would you be my best man? And so came home, and Lillian was ready to get married. And we got married. I was home, what, 1 day or 2 days, and we got married. And then the next day, we got in the train and went back to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. The railroad ended at Raleigh, North Carolina, and we got a bus, ended up in Fort Bragg. And the little got a job there in the dime store at Fayetteville, $1 a day. And
you've now been married 64 years, too.
And we've been married past 64 years. The 9th of September of this year was 64 years. And Lil would come out to the dispensary, and she'd come out to camp on Sunday and for dinner and stuff like that, and then I'd go back and with her, and occasionally I could go back. And she had an apartment and not very much of an apartment, because in a soldier town it was pretty hard to get a place. And anyway, we got by, and then we left Fort Bragg. Oh, I suppose. We was all together, was it down there, a year and a half. We ended up in a camp in down by Hoffman, North Carolina, out in the swamps. It was we were down there back in our 50th anniversary, and I went to the camp, and it was restricted. It was a training base for soldiers, the elite soldiers. Anyway, I didn't go in. They really didn't want me to go in. And anyway, we went down there and went to Fort Bragg and went to the hospital that Lillian was in, found it, and looked around, and Fort Bragg was really changed. It was huge. Found the old theater I went to. Well, found the hospital that Lillian was for delivering the baby. And our first son was born. Wasn't too long after that, Lillian went back to Sioux Falls, went overseas, ended up in, I think we ended up in New Jersey. I got in the train, went up there, got in New Jersey, and then got in a boat. And our outfit was in the bottom compartment of the boat going overseas, and it took us 2 weeks to go overseas. Ended up in London, ended up in London. And on the boat, and on the way over, we had quite a scare. I mean, it took us 2 weeks. It was the winter time we went over, and it was huge, the waves. It was scary, and I could hear that. When we were, could hear the water It was down the bottom. You could hear the water up there, and I thought, what if a torpedo comes in there? And there were two guys standing by that door and had rubber around it. And their job was, if something happened, they'd close that door, and the fellas that was in that room would just have to drink all that water or drown. And I thought, well, I'm just going to take my life jacket and go up and set up on the top deck. And so I went up and set on the top deck, because I could see the danger of being in that room. And I'm looking out there, and those waves looked like they were about 6-7 stories high. And it was horrifying. I think it was 23. So finally, we got closer to England, and then they were shooting these big barrels of dynamite off in the boat because they said the submarines were down there. A lot of guys wanted to get at the top. And in the wintertime, you wouldn't last 3 minutes in that water. And I know there was 10,000 of us, and they're in the 13th Armored Division was in their part on that boat, you see. They don't put a whole division in one boat. They just put parcels. Better than that, they spread you around. Because if they lose one, you can always lose the headquarters outfit, but the lane about it. Anyway, we finally got out of there and got to England, and then all of a sudden, a whole lot of boats went towards France, and got off the boat and opened up the great big door, and here's the landing barge down there, and holds 200 men, and you grab all your stuff, and you have this big sea bag, and it's about, oh, I suppose it's about that big around, about 10 inches through, and it's about that high, and all your stuff's in there, and you're supposed to lug it, and you lug it over a certain place, and somebody's always throwing them bags here, and you're right by this door, and you're going right out this door, and you're looking for your bag, and the guy says, grab one, he says, and get over there, and he says, hold on to it, and there's guys climbing down on it, and you grab this bag around your shoulder. And I got one that was a paratrooper's bag, and he had two of these heavy ropes in there. I was a medic and had two big bags of medical supplies, plus my bag in the back in there, my bag back there. And I just weighed 135 pounds. And there I grabbed down there and got down there, that rope ladder, back crawling backwards and got on that bar. Finally got down there, got in that boat. And you can't sit down. Stand up over there with your stuff. And you go over there and stand over there, and finally 200 guys get in that landing barge, and that goes back, and they go over there, and they circle around and around, and all these barges are circling around till they get all these guys off of that. And you don't go to shore one boat at a time or barge at a time. And you're standing up there, and you get pretty tired, but you're just in there crammed like beans. And so here it was pitch dark, and finally they go up to shore, and this was Normandy Beach heading. And you go up to shore, and you get out of the water, and you walk through the water, and you get up the beach, and it's pitch dark. You can't see your hand in front of your face. All you can hear is somebody shouting. And here I heard my name, and I had this bag, and I couldn't carry it no more. And so I just drug it in the water and everything in sand, and finally hollering my name, and here's a big livestock truck. Well, anyway, and he is a semi, and they got over there and hollered my name, and I got over there, and I guess I must have been the last one, or I don't know. Anyway, get up here. And so they got my bag up there, and I got up there, and I got in that truck, and you don't sit down or lay down or anything. You stand up. It was plumb full. And so I was sitting in there, and I was hungry. So when I was aboard ship, I thought, well, I'll take my mess gear, and I had a gas mask, and I took my mess gear, the little plate, you know, the lid on it, and I took about 5 boiled eggs, and I put them in there. And I said, when I'm hungry, I'll open that up and get a boiled egg and eat a boiled egg. And so I reached in my gas mask, and here that kettle, the lid came off, and then all them eggs were all over my gas mask in there, and I had to clean that all up. And I didn't get nothing to eat. And so finally, we went through either Holland or Belgium, and on this truck. And as we went through the towns, the people were had the houses were the street was here, and the houses were up here, and they'd look out. They had the windows open to look out and wave at you. And anyway, we got to an airfield, and we went there, and there was snow on the ground, and there was tents up, but the what's it called, were flapping, and they put so many of us in each one tent, and they said, get busy and secure the tent and put snow around the bottom of the tent and get in there and get yourself a bunk and get in there and sleep for the night. And so we did that, and there we were at that place. I don't know. We were there about 2 weeks. And so the next morning we looked out, and the guy said, hey, he said, there's a French woman. He said, you ever seen a French woman? And so everybody went out and looked, and there she was. She was about 4 feet high and short, and she was old, and everybody went back in the tent. And she wasn't very appealing. And so anyway, we were there for a while, and no stove. And finally, they had a stove in there, and finally they brought us some coal, and we started a fire. And pretty soon, somebody came and they said, you can get some hot water. Go to someone and went over there, take your helmet, and he hadn't shaved or washed or anything for a few days. So went over there, and the guy gave us about, I don't know if you ever seen a canteen cup or not, and he gave us that much water, hot water. And you brushed your teeth, you washed your face, you shaved, and you took a bath down to your waist. It felt good. And I learned how to shave and do all that stuff I don't think it was a quart of water.
Tell me about maybe a highlight or two while you were there.
After we left that outfit, let's see, we got, where did we go? Oh, yeah, we went up and we was a backup troop for that British general, Montgomery. And he was doing trench warfare, and we was in back of him, and you could hear the shells, the bombing and stuff, like, and fighting back and forth, and we could hear that. We was reserve troop for Montgomery, and he wasn't a very appealing general. Anyway, we was with him for about, I don't know, it seemed like a month or more. All of a sudden, they pulled us away from there, and you see, we was an airborne outfit, and airborne soldiers aren't your average soldier. I mean, they're average soldier, but I mean, they're used for going back enemy lines. And so they pulled us out of there and had us in an airfield, and was in that airfield for some time. And then they'd get you ready, and then they'd come on to get your write your last letters, because we're going to get ready to go. And so, you know, I don't know how you feel, but you have a strange feeling when you're writing your last letter before you go into combat. And then the post guy comes around and gets all your letters, and you write your letter to your wife and your parents, and you get ready, and you do what you're told. And so all of a sudden you're ready to do that, and then they come in and call it off. And they did that 3 times. And we were the last airborne outfit to be used. And what they do is you go in a glider, and the paratroopers go in there, and they secure the ground. Then the gliders come in, and I was a glider soldier. And he's in a glider, and that was called off. And finally, the American soldiers were able to push the Germans back and secure things, and they didn't. They had the Germans on the run, and so they didn't use us. And so we were slated to come back to the United States. And so we were in rented up in a chateau that the Germans had. And we got in there, and what a chateau was like was like a school for people. And it had a kitchen, a shower, and it had big area for soldiers to sleep, bunks and that, and a kitchen. And we were there for, oh, quite some time. And we fixed a shower up in the place so we could use it. And we used a shower. And as I was showering one day, I noticed that my scrotum was extra large. And here my intestines came through one of the holes in my body down here and was filling up my scrotum. So I went and seen my captain, the doctor. And so he stood me on my head in a corner of the room, and he helped me get my intestines back out of my scrotum. And he said, "Ed," he said, "you'll have to report back in the morning." He said, "Sick call," he said. And he said, "You'll have to have surgery." But he said, "If you're smart," he said, "you'll end back up in the States." So I reported a sick call, and we were pretty close to the enemy lines, and went to a hospital, a field hospital. It was all tents. And so got an ambulance there and went there, and the guy said, "You're here for the night." And so we stayed there, and the next morning he came in, "And Barrett, your name?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Sign this paper." And I says, "What's it for?" "Well," he says, "in case they make a mistake on your surgery," he says, "the government's not liable." Well, I said, "I'm not going to sign that." He said, "You aren't going to sign that." He said, "You'd better." And I said, "I'm not going to sign it." Well, man, they got mad. So I was there another day. So the next morning, Barrett, getting an ambulance there. So took me back into the hospital. I think I was in three or five hospitals doing that, and I wouldn't sign it. I wouldn't have a surgery in a tent. And being that if they made a mistake or something, that I wouldn't have any help or anything. So I ended up, took me 73 days, the time I left my outfit, that the war had ended, 73 days, till I got on a boat to come back to the United States. And ended up in different hospitals and stuff like that, just laying in bed, and I'd take care of myself. And so finally got on a boat and came back home on the George Washington. And the boat had so many guys on there that we had to stay on the deck. And they had canvas all around the boat on so we'd sleep in bunks on there. And I ended up in Boston Harbor in a hospital ship, and ended up in a hospital train. And I got on the train, and I ended up in the train. I came all the way across the United States. I ended up through Chicago, came through Aberdeen, went to Stokane, Washington, a hospital out there, and I had my surgery out there. And before I had my surgery, I'd walk around, you know, and I ended up in a quarters where the soldiers were from Japan, and they were terrible looking. I mean, they were the fellas that the Japs had kept as prisoners of war. And I felt sorry for myself until I looked at them fellas, and then I felt ashamed of myself. And so I then had my surgery, and I had two doctors work on me. And one was teaching the other doctor how to do the surgery. And I was laying there, and the nurse didn't give me an enema. And here I was having the surgery, and I got such pains. And finally, they sewed me up, and I finally got out. Oh, I suppose I had, after my surgery, it was about 5, 6, 7 days, and I wanted to get out of there and come home. And finally, I talked to the doctor, and he says, "You think you can get along okay?" And I says, "I get along all right." And I think it's about 7, 8 days after my surgery, and then they give me a pass to come home. And so I got a pass, and I went to the airfield, and I bummed a ride on an airplane. And I ended up in Omaha, Nebraska, in the airfield there. And then I got another airplane, and it got me an airfield to Sioux City, Nebraska. And, man, no buses or anything. And so I started hitchhiking from Sioux City, and I got a ride. And I ended home.
And quite a homecoming, I'd imagine, with your wife and your
Yep.
son there.
And then I finally got my discharge over in Wisconsin, and I altogether the time that I spent in the service was 4 years and 2 days. And I was glad that I came home just fine. I met a lot of fellas and I learned a lot, and I learned to keep my mouth shut and to do what you're told and never, never go AWOL. Anyway, the fella that took my job over, was a tech sergeant. I would have been a tech sergeant. And so I'd say to any young service person, do what they tell you, you'll be a lot better off. And if you go to school, take all the schooling you can get. And it might be monotonous, it seem like it's a waste of time, but really, when you get through, it isn't. But I was an expert with needles, and I did my job. I really took good care of my outfit. I didn't get any big rating, but just that little bit on my, that even the General Eric Molitor would come. I was on CQ at noon. He would come. He had his own records. He would come in, and I would give this most of the officers shots because they never felt it, because I had to pinch them and then stab them.
A
And
good trick to use.
I had learned a lot, and I should have, when I came home, I should have went up to Brookings and went to the pharmacy and been a pharmacist, because I mixed medicine. The doctors would show me how to do it, what to do, and we mixed cough medicine, other things. We'd make pills. I seen my brother-in-law, one of my brother-in-laws, and he was farming, and it was such a relief and relaxing, and nobody was on your butt. Nobody told you what to do. And I'd worked at Morrell's, and as always, when I got a job, I came home. And I went to the hospital, McKinnon, and that was only a dollar a day. And at Morrell's, I got $1.02. So I went there, and I finally ended up at Old Home Bakery. I worked there at night and as a second job. And I went farming, and we ended up on the farm.
Well, fabulous. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today. We appreciate it.
Well, you're more than welcome. I mean, and being in this suit makes me feel young.
And how old are you?
I'll be 88 in November the 22nd of this year, and I go to the VA hospital, and the doctor, what is my doctor? A lady doctor. And the other doctors, and they've never seen anybody like me because of my health.